Lacan is known as the French Freud. And what that means is that he translated Freud into French. However, what it means at a somewhat deeper level is that there is a translation dispute between the English Freud as is used in America and the French Freud as is used in France. Lacan, it is easiest to see where Lacan's coming from if you see him as defining himself in opposition to a mistranslation of Freud as is practiced in America. And the primary area of dispute is about the nature of the ego and its discontents. If you want to get yourself psychoanalyzed nowadays, then you have a choice. If you happen to be living in France, or you happen to be living in South America, Lacan is very big in South America, then you would look up an analyst and you would find that that analyst is going to be a Lacanian, although it is possible to find classic Freudian analysts in both France and South America. My dear friend of a long time, who's a prof at the in Paris, and he was analysed. He was analysed according to classic Freudian techniques using the couch. But most people in France, they would find themselves being analysed by a Lacanian. If you're in England, you would find it would be normally classic Freud, although you can find also Lacanians. In America, overwhelmingly normally, it would be classic Freud. There are about, worldwide, it's 50-50 split between the two. That's the importance of Lacan. And anybody writing in literary criticism, unless they're specifically studying texts that were produced in Freud's big catchment area, which is in the period of sexual repression of Victorianism, would normally be doing Lacanian rather than simply Freudian analysis. You will find if you read psychoanalytic literary criticism. All right, what is this dispute? The best way of describing it is a dispute about what Freud meant when he in this famous phrase, which is translated in the English Freud, the classic Strachey translation, as "where id was, there shall ego be." Now, what does that mean? Well, what that would seem to mean would be that there is this dark, undiscovered continent in our minds, and that you can bring the ego into it and colonize it to some extent. That you can bring the clear white light of reason into the blackness and civilize it. And if there is some sort of rebellion, if there is some sort of incursion from the darkness into consciousness, then that can be brought under control by psychoanalysis and can be rendered rational, can be explained, and as a result of that explanation, if done in the proper way, you will become happy. That is known as ego reinforcement. As a result of that process, your ego will become stronger and more able to do the job that it does, which is getting you through from one day to the next. In American Freud, what ego reinforcement does is particularly to reinforce the habit of the ego in accumulating stuff. The ego is a device that in the simplest of beings makes them pursue things that they want to eat and want to have sex with for purposes of survival and procreation. Since humans are incredibly much more complex than that because we have the extraordinary complex device of language, what that can translate into is acquiring material possessions. So in America, if you're so neurotic that you don't like going near the shopping mall, you go and get yourself, it's a parody, right? You go and get yourself analysed, and over a period of time, your analyst will sort that out so that you can go down the shopping mall and acquire some possessions and you take them home and feel happy for 5 minutes, and then you go down the shopping mall again and get some more, right? This is the way Lacan would describe American Freud. It is utterly the opposite of what Lacan believes. It is utterly 180 degrees the opposite of what Lacan believes. For Lacan, the ego is the source of the problem. In fact, one of my bright graduate students told me the other day, Lacan said, the ego is a symptom. The ego is another symptom. I will explain what that means in a bit. If that's the case, if the ego is the problem, given that both the Lacanians and the American Freudians are dealing with precisely the same 24-volume set of collected works of Sigmund Freud, how come they have opposite interpretations? How can you possibly have two totally opposed interpretations of the same body of works? Well, but I'll explain how, with regard to this example, where id was, there shall ego be. That's not what Freud says. That is the classic Strachey translation that is on everybody's lips who's interested in psychoanalysis. It's not what the guy said. This is what he said. Wo es war, soll ich werden. All right, I will translate that for you word by word. Wo means where. Ich means I, me, I. And it was Freud's word, you remember, Freud didn't use the word ego. Freud said das Ich, the I. And for id, he didn't say id, he said es, it. Das es, the it. Okay, so go back to this. Where it was, soll. Now, soll is stronger than the English word should. It means, it has a feeling of moral, does anyone know German? Feeling of moral compulsion about it?
Yeah, it's like ought to be, but yeah, with moral.
Right. Phew. Soll ich, the ego, ich. Werden does not mean be. It definitely does not mean be. This is a blatant mistranslation. It means become. Where it was, should I become? Must I become? What does that mean? Well, actually, if you show that to a German, they look at it and they get very puzzled, and what you characteristically get is a long silence. Because right? I've shown it to Oliver Mason, a very bright guy and a linguist, and I've shown it to Wolfgang Teubert, who's a very, very, very bright guy and a famous linguist, and got the same response. They look at it and they go very silent, and they don't give you an answer. So I showed it to a professor of German, who's an irascible guy, and he shouted at me. This is what Lacan says it means. Là où c'était, there, where, it was. Là, there, où, where, c'était, it was. C'est mon devoir que, so he's strengthening it to get the feeling of Zoll. It is my duty that. C'est mon devoir, it is my devoir, my duty, that. Je viens à être. I come to be. it is my duty that I should come to be, should come into existence. Translating Freud's Werden. Now that is a very beautiful French sentence, classic French sentence, and it is an exact translation of what Freud says. Okay?
Could you say the end bit again? Sorry.
Je viens à être. I come to be. Sorry. Lean forward. Or you could say, for a translation of that French, I come into being. Slightly loose, but it still honours the French. And it also honours the German, werden, I become. All right? Now, what does that mean? Well, what Lacan thought of the relationship between the ego and the unconscious is this. He thought, rather than assimilating bits of the unconscious into the ego, disastrous idea, because the ego for Lacan is the source of neurosis. What therapy should do is expose the ego to be informed, illuminated, vivified by the unconscious. You should open yourself up to the unconscious in order to receive its mischievous, frame-breaking, undermining, enlivening, witty material. Now, if you put it like that, that's like Jung. For Jung, you certainly should not colonize the unconscious because it knows a hell of a lot more than you do, and you would be stupid to do that. For Jung, what should happen is that you go into the unconscious to learn by it and to be revived by it and to fill your life with meaning. That is actually very light. I mean, Lacan would hate it because he always claimed that he was a Freudian. He would have nothing to do with Jung. But actually, the Lacanian interpretation, for you who've done Jung and have got a good grasp on it, is actually easier to understand if you think of it in terms of Jung. Do you see what I mean? Now, so are we okay so far? That's the difference between the two theories, right? However, this is Lacan, okay? Lacan is really peculiar. He's really weird. What he does, that I've not quoted the whole of Lacan's translation. The whole of Lacan's translation is here. And what he is doing here is not only telling you what the unconscious is like, he is also showing you by this extraordinary interruption to the rational, beautiful French sentence. Là où c'était, okay, you know what that means, ou bien, that means or rather, là où c'était, it's a pun, it sounds exactly the same. The only problem is that it is not possible to translate c'était with an S into English or any other language because it is nonsense. It is total nonsense. It has no meaning whatsoever. I took that sentence to Kerry Crossley's friend of mine who was professor of French at the time, very serious guy, takes French very, very seriously. I show it to him. I say, Kerry, look, I've got a class in a minute. What does that mean? And so he looks at it, and then he looks at it, then he looks at it, and he said, Tom, this is bullshit. And that's what Lacan does. He does bullshit. He does creative bullshit. One of the stories of Lacan is, you know, right, he was in occupied France during the war. His wife was Jewish. Right? It's very serious business, okay? So the Gestapo set up a headquarters in Paris, and they start going through the records. Everybody's ID card is called in. They're looking for the Jews. What are they going to do to the Jews? They're going to put them in trains and ship them to Auschwitz. Lacan went into Gestapo headquarters. He was in there for half an hour. He came out carrying his wife's ID, which he took and burned. his wife was not shipped off to Auschwitz. How did he do that? Nobody knows. This is the Gestapo, right? These are not pussycats, okay? He did it because he was a master of bullshit. He was a master of the subversion that comes from the unconscious. What he is doing here is, instead of speaking about the unconscious, he is speaking from the unconscious. The unconscious speaks in slips of the tongue, in jokes, in puns, in rhymes. We know that from Freud's books, from his book on the parapraxies, slips of the tongue, and his book on jokes. So, supposing you were to actually analyse that bit of unconscious, how would you do it? Well, look, what it is, it's incredibly difficult to explain it because you can't translate it into French, let alone into English. But it's something like this. It's a reflexive, right? The S bit is a reflexive. What's a reflexive? A reflexive sentence must consist, as a minimum, of the following three items. He hit himself. Subject, verb, reflexive pronoun. I love myself. Subject, Freudian slip. I love myself. Subject, verb, reflexive pronoun. You hate yourself. Got to have those three elements, right? Now, that is the reflexive pronoun. Let's say it means himself. And that's the verb, was. There's no subject. It's like hit himself. That's not a sentence. Doesn't exist. It's a subjectless sentence. What is the unconscious? It's a subjectless discourse. The unconscious, which Lacan calls the other with a capital A, outre, A-U-T-R-E, the other, is where I am not. During Theories of the Mind, we talk easily and freely about the contents of the unconscious. It's got collective unconscious, it's got an anima in it, it's got this and that, or it's got, in Freud, it's got the Oedipus complex, etc. So it's as if the unconscious is familiar territory. That's a misconception. The unconscious is unconscious, it's unbewusst, it is not known. You can only know it by its byproducts and by its interruptions into the speech of the ego, into the discourse of the ego. And that's what Lacan really stresses. It is the unness, the otherness of the unconscious. And what that is saying is that the unconscious, that's why he's using his pun. Two things. One, it's a pun because he says that's the way the unconscious talks. Two, it is subjectless, and three, it interrupts normal speech. Listen, here's a Lacanian, we're in a Lacanian analytic practice, and there's the analyst, and here, sitting opposite, he didn't use the couch, is the analyst, and the analyst is going on about his problems, and on, and on. What the analyst wants to know is what the analysand wants to know is what the analyst thinks. And that will not be the answer because the analyst... And so what the analysand does is to try to analyse his stuff and to go on about it and tell you about his wife and tell you about his problems with his father and the problems with this. And all of that is irrelevant. The analyst is hardly listening because the analyst knows that that is the ego talking. And the speech of the ego, says Lacan, is false speech. So she lets the analysand go on, and then at some point there will come an interruption in this false speech. There will be a slip of the tongue. There will be something unexpected and strange and remarkable that interrupts this discourse of the ego. And at this point, the analyst says, are. And like the true speech of the unconscious, will interrupt the discourse and say, look at that. And that's when the analysis starts, from there. So the unconscious for Lacan speaks true speech. The ego speaks false speech. What is this true speech like? So the example, Freud wrote a... No, I'll start from this. When I wrote that first lecture, that basic lecture about Freud, I, like Freud in round about 1900, was thinking of the unconscious as a container, a cellar where you put stuff that you don't like, the unbearable. You just put it down there and batten the hatches and keep it down. For later Freud, however, the Freud of the book about jokes and the book about slips of the tongue, the unconscious is more like a discourse. It is more like a language. So, for instance, let me give you an example of a really wonderful slip of the tongue. This is the former President of the United States, George Bush. God bless him. He is giving a talk to a whole bunch of teachers. So this is a very big deal, right? The President of the United States is holding forth to some teachers. Gets up, grabs the lectern, you know, addresses the audience, and he says, first, we must spank all the teachers. Meant to say thank, right? Now, that is so beautiful in Freudian terms because it is the fulfillment of a disguised wish. I mean, it's just perfect, right? This guy had a totally messed up education. He was a cokehead and he was an alcoholic and he was a spoiled rich kid and he wasted his time at the university, the expensive universities that his father bought for him. And he has resentments, which in Freudian terms would translate into death wishes towards the teachers, and it comes out as a perfect slip of the tongue. What Lacan is interested in is, what is the characteristic of that slip of the tongue? The characteristic is that it rhymes. Spank. Thank. From that, and from numerous other examples, he derives the proposition that the speech of the unconscious is pitched at the level of the signifier, of the way that words sound. The unconscious speaks in rhymes. The unconscious calls attention to the way, to the signifier, to the way in which words sound. So for Freud, and for particularly for Lacan, what is going on is that there are two discourses in your mind. There is the conscious discourse, which is more or less rational, discursive, consecutive, logical, and rather colourless and uninteresting, false speech. Underneath that, there is another voice going all the time that you're not aware of. That's the unconscious, the voice of the other. And that is not logical, not consecutive, not any of the tedious things that this is, and it is subversive, and it is pitched according to, it is based on the sounds of words, so the unconscious speaks in rhymes. Let me point to another thing about this interruption of Lacan. The unconscious does momentary interruptions. The unconscious does not speak in continuous consecutive things. It breaks into the conscious discourse. And what it does when it does that, if you take it, if you catch it at the right moment, is that it changes everything. It makes strange. And that's quite similar to Jung. If you go to a Jungian analyst with your problem, then what your analyst will do is, particularly if your analyst happens to be Jung, what your problem is probably going to be is your midlife crisis. And what happens in the midlife crisis is that you become depressed, your world becomes empty, you become listless, you become very bored because life has lost meaning. It is grey. And what the Jungian will do is, will do, at some point, will do magic. There will be something inexplicable and transformative that happens, that comes from the unconscious, like you will meet your shadow, your anima, whatever, animus, and you will be transformed. Lacan does something exactly the same. The analyst must speak with the voice of the unconscious, must interrupt the tedious, problematic speech of the ego, and that interruption will be healing, disturbing, subversive, and transformative, like magic. Are you with me so far? You can ask questions at this point if you want.
Is there a reason why, does he give a reason for why the unconscious decides to break through at all in slips and stuff?
No, because there is no reason about the unconscious. It will be a pressure point. It's like, why does the volcano erupt there? Because it's a pressure point. Because, you know, the surface is thin. It's because what you have done is you have created something on the surface which is an issue. You don't know it's an issue. President Bush didn't know that he had this death wishes towards the teacher. But that's where the unconscious chooses to come through. Does that answer your question? Okay. So what is the nature then of the unconscious? The unconscious is a discourse, but we can more fully define what that discourse is like by defining what the ego is like. And that is what that map is up there. So, to give you a quick translation into words of that, that diamond bit in the middle is a mathematical expression and it means is defined in relation to. S is the subject, the ego, le moi, the me, which is split. It's split because I have an unconscious mind that I'm not aware of. So I am divided without knowing it. The split subject is defined in relation to big A. A is short for ultra, A-U-T-R-E, which is the French word for other, over little a, which is also means other, but it's a different kind of other. So the discourse of the conscious mind defines itself in relation to the discourse of the unconscious mind divided by little a, which is what I'll talk to you about towards the end of this session. How does that happen? Well, let us look at the way in which, according to Lacan, the ego gets to be. So there is the child, the baby, and it knows nothing. It thinks everything is me. It knows maybe that bits of me don't seem to be doing what I want, so that there will be discontent and I'm not being fed and I scream and then I get fed, but it's all me. As the child's vision starts to work properly, then images will appear. Now, note, those images have no logic, because logic is a matter of the next stage, which is the symbol E. Logic is provided by language, and I don't have language yet. The images irrationally come and go, and you know, there is some familiarity, mummy. There is some response, smile, you smile at a smile if you're a baby. But you have no way of controlling the world, and you have no way of predicting the world, which is very scary. Now, animals, which are extremely sophisticated entities and very, very good at survival, because otherwise if they weren't good at survival, they would not exist. My cats, for instance, are very good at being in the world, and they have enormous martial arts skills and extraordinary capabilities, but they're scared. You must have noticed with cats, you know, as soon as a sound that they can't classify, the ears go up like that. And if it sounds dangerous, they'll be on guard, just like that. That's because they don't control the world with language. They are in the imaginary. They only see images, and they cannot do, in any complicated way, put those images into a system so that they know what the world is. That's just the postman knocking at the door. They don't know that. They don't know what a postman is. They don't really know what a door is. They don't know what a knock is. It's just a noise. They can to some extent accumulate the set of sounds that may or may not, that may possibly happen around the house, so that they know that when my car arrives to get by the front door and look endearing, because they may well get fed, right? So they recognize that sound. That's part of a system, but it's a very, very simple system. And as a result, most of the time they are quite scared, and sometimes they are very scared. So you see cats out there in the garden, they're looking around like this because they don't classify the world. That's what it's like for the baby. It can't classify the world. It just sees images, and these images are kind of magical and dreamy and a bit scary. But fortunately, you have the comforting feeling of being looked after and protected by mummy, your primary carer who feeds you. That's what the imaginaire is like, and it's important for us to realize what the imaginaire is like, because when the symbolic comes in, when you learn language, that is repressed. The imaginary becomes a bunch of images that are down there in your unconscious, behaving in the way that they behave for you as a baby, which is without logic, a bit scary, bizarre, strange, rather gothic, incomprehensible, magical. So it is possible to write a class of literature that accesses the imaginaire. And that class of literature is in fact the gothic. The literature of fantasy, where anything can happen, where there is no logic, or relatively little logic, and it's exciting and beautiful and scary. There, direct application to literature. The other thing about the imaginaire is, and this is an amazing insight of Lacan, it is, for Lacan, it is a mirror. So the entry into the imaginary is signaled in terms of construction of the ego by the child looking into a mirror and thinking, that's me out there. That's what I look like. And at that point, you're no longer part of your mother because you've identified a me to be. That is a process of construction of the me. And that me that you see in the mirror is the foundation of what's known as the ego ideal, E-G-O-I-D-E-A-L, the ideal ego. And so this fragment of me that you see, because you can only ever see part of yourself in the mirror, is the basis for the construction in imaginary terms of the ego. And you will add to that in your construction of the ego all sorts of other fragments, images, concepts, including the desire of the mother who wants you to be all sorts of things, and that will make up the foundation of your ego before language kicks in and starts changing things. So remember that the imaginary is also a mirror. And that is how Lacan would interpret Jung's theory. Because what Jung wanted to do, you to do, according to Lacan, would be to go into the imaginary and learn from it. And when you get there, says Jung, you will find it scary and full of images and a bit gothic and unpredictable. That must be the Lacanian imaginaire. Jung, of course, has a whole different interpretation of it, and I'm not here to tell you which one of them is right, but I'm telling you that's the way that Lacan would interpret Jung's psychology. Okay, what happens next is that language comes along, and in Lacan that is associated with the father. The father's job is to set limits. In the imaginaire, there are no limits. And this is a reflection of the roles of the two main protagonists in your life, the primary carer and the secondary carer. The primary carer is the one who begins, is the nurturer, is the one who says, yes, dear, of course you can. And the secondary carer is the one who enters from outside this magic circle of mother and child, so well represented in Western iconography, and says, stop there, go no further. If you are lacking in both, you will be an unhappy child. If you're in a supermarket checkout and there is a child who has not had enough input from the secondary carer and is saying, I want, give me that, loudly, irritating everybody, that's secondary carer deficiency. I remember I was at a party once and we were all sort of sitting on the floor in a circle eating stuff, and there were candles, which was pretty stupid because there were very small children there. And I'm a very strict secondary carer, partly because I read Lacan. And there was this little kid, and he was reaching towards the candle. And I'm thinking, stop that, set a limit, for God's sake. And his mother was looking on. I can't believe this, you know, she's looking on. I can't interrupt that magic circle because I don't have that license, because I'm not the secondary carer there, right? So the child put his finger in the flame and screamed and looked at his mother with such loss, such wounded. The world has suddenly, you know, changed for this kid, because the nurturer has produced, as it were, something for him that doesn't nurture. I don't know what the father was doing, I can't say. But that drama speaks to me. That is my image of the relationship between primary care and secondary care. It's about limits and boundaries. Now, that's what language does. Language is an extraordinarily efficient invention for setting limits and boundaries. I feel very safe about that stone there because it's a stone. I've labelled it. It's a stone. I know that it won't leap up and kill me, because stones don't do that. And I've read that in many books, and I've been taught that, and the whole of language is telling me that stones don't leap up and kill me, or spontaneously roll away of its own so that I've got to catch it. And I've got the whole of this room pretty well tied down. You know, there are books and there are students and there are cushions, blah, blah, blah. All of those words. And therefore, I'm in control of this environment, and I am not, as the cat is, scared, because I've got it all classified. Everything's got a label attached to it, and with that label comes, this is my room, safety, this is my place, I know where I am, I know what I do. Things could disrupt that, but they would have to be very unusual. Somebody walks in with a gun, world changes. But I would still have a way of dealing with that, because I know what a gun is and I can recognise it. Might not be able to do anything about it, but I would know what was going on. My cat wouldn't know, because my cat doesn't know what a gun is. He doesn't know how incredibly dangerous guns are, because he's never seen a gun. I think it was a funny smell, but that's all. And he might pick up on the vibes, which would be rather wild. But anyway, so what you do, what the enormous benefit of language is that it sets limits and makes you in charge of your world, and it controls things. But, says Lacan, but. The world that you create with language is not the real world. It is a subset, it is not even a subset of the real world, it is a subset of all linguistic possibilities. And what you do when language, you allow language to create you as a being, as a person, as a subject, is to separate out your language, sane language, your controlled language, from mad language. Language that doesn't make sense. Language that is weird. Language that is strange, scary, peculiar, ungrammatical, bizarre. All of that gets excluded. You only create yourself from language that makes sense to you. That is the way the subject is defined in the symbolic order, as opposed to the imaginary order, is defined in language. You do it by exclusion of the nonsensical, the unimaginable, by exclusion of the unspeakable. And the fact that that word conveys a bit of horror to it is appropriate, because the other language is unspeakable and it's kind of horrifying. That, for Lacan, is the unconscious. That is big A. Right? Ultra. That is the discourse. Remember the two discourses? The false speech of the conscious is the language that you constitute yourself with. The true speech of the unconscious is the rest of language that you have excluded, the unspeakable language. And that's the language discourse. That is the discourse of the unconscious, the discourse of capital A. What then is small a? Both of those discourses do not describe the real world. The real world, the world as it really is, cannot be described in language. It is that which cannot be described in language, and it is called by Lacan the real. And he gives the real incredible status, because there are only three orders of being: the imaginary, the symbolic, and the real, and they each have equal status. And one of them is unknowable. But the reason why it is enormously important in Lacan is because it is where our desire goes. We know that we are excluded from it. We don't know what it is. We can't say it. We can't think it. We can't imagine it, but we know it, and therefore we desire it. So we have this lack, la manque. I think it's la manque, it might be le manque. We have this lack inside us as a third of our being, our desire. And it is desire for the utterly unattainable. And we seek to satisfy that desire by going down to the mall and shopping. But the reason why the shopping doesn't satisfy us is because it's not what we want. It is not what we desire. What we desire is the real. But there is hope. There is a way of getting a notion, of getting some kind of contact with the real. And you can't really talk about it. You can only express it by paradox. The word that Lacan uses for the apprehension, first of the unconscious, then of the real, is called jouissance. J-O-U-I-S-S-A-N-C-E. Jouissance. Now, that's a perfectly normal, polite French word. You can use it in a drawing room and it won't cause anybody to knock over a teacup. It means enjoyment. but it is also the normal French word for orgasm. What Lacan seems to mean by it is a pleasure that is so pleasurable that it is painful, and a pain that is so painful that it is pleasurable. So I will call it pleasure pain. Now, you see, by doing that, I'm breaking down a distinction in language. And that's what jouissance is. It is about the apprehension of a breakdown in the categorization power of the symbolic that makes the world that we experience and thereby excludes us from the real. That was good. Remember that. That's what it's about. So, for instance, when I was wrestling with that là où c'était, that paradox, that joke, that intrusion from the unconscious, I was wrestling with that for days, trying to get some way of translating it so that I could put it across to you. And I told my daughter about it in an email. She's fluent in French. And she was wrestling with it for 2 hours. She just sat there for 2 hours trying to figure it out. And there is a pain in that, but there is also a pleasure. It's like a riddle, a pleasure pain. And if you have an insight, which you do frequently with Lacan, and you move on to somehow onto the next level, it's, oh my God, I've got something. That's jouissance. And what you are beginning to apprehend is some kind of glimpse of the real, where your real desire is satisfied, temporarily, momentarily. The apprehension of the real is little a. He calls it objet petit a. Object little a, O-B-J-E-T, petit, P-E-T-I-T, a, small a, objet petit a. And it is objet petit a which gives you that is the glimpse of the real. Now, how do you get that? Well, it's like the voice of the unconscious. It speaks in riddles, it speaks in paradoxes, it is painful, it is pleasurable, it is like poetry. The voice of the unconscious for Lacan is like poetry, but it's like a specific kind of poetry, surrealist poetry. Now, that's difficult to get across to English people because in English literature, surrealist poetry is usually comic. "'Twas Brillig and the Slithy Toves did gyre and gimble in the wave," right? That's comic. "Alice in Wonderland" is kind of a comedy, although it's a scary comedy. But in French and in Spanish and in other Romance languages, surrealism is taken very seriously indeed. So what I'm going to finish with is an example of poetry that has very considerable power that doesn't make sense. And it is not this not making of sense that gives you the feeling of jouissance, of breaking through. So this is a poem by, a Spanish poem, by Lorca. Lorca was a very beautiful man. And he lived in, he died in Spain in 1939. In his life, at the age, he was about 40 when he died, no, late 30s. And Lorca is known to all Spanish people as one of the greatest, maybe the greatest lyric poet in the whole of Spanish, right? Whole of Spanish literature. He is a giant, and he's also a playwright. He works with surrealism. What happened to Lorca was that he crazily, because he was gay, he was overtly gay, he was out. He went back into Spain at the time of the Spanish Civil War, and he went into the bit that was held by the fascists. And they arrested him, and a couple of days later, they took him out early in the morning, took him to an olive grove, and shot him. Bang, there go the poems. They shot him for being gay. 2-3 days before he died, he wrote this poem. This is Lorca's death poem. And I've translated it into English, and actually I toned down the surrealism. But what I want you to listen to is the way in which it's nonsense. It doesn't make sense. but it's signifying nonsense, and its signification has great power. So listen to this. It's called The Darkness of Death, a love poem. I want to sleep the way apples dream, not in some rowdy cemetery. I want to sleep the way that dreaming boy tried to open his heart to the fathomless sea. I don't want to hear how the dead die bloodless, how the mouth in its wasting calls out for water. I don't want to hear about death in the undergrowth or the poisoned teeth of the moon before dawn. I want to sleep for a moment, a minute, a millennium. But I want them to know that I have not died, that in my mouth there are golden horses, that I am the youth lover of the west wind, that I am the overarching shadow of my tears. Hide me from the dawn. I don't want to wake with ants in my mouth. Pour on my shoes the weight of water so that I can evade the scorpion's claw. For I want to sleep the way apples dream, to learn the tears that will cleanse me of clay. For I want to live with that dark youth who tried to open his heart to the fathomless sea.